This morning, I'd like for us to look at primarily what Paul teaches to the Roman church in the book of Romans, chapters 9, 10, 11. He's teaching them something that would seem to be not as important to us now, because it had everything to do with what was going on at the time. But he spends three chapters on it, so it's important. And it does have an importance for us as well. And I would put a title on it to show the importance to us as God is in control. Okay, God is in control of the church. He's in control of the perpetuity of the church. And the fact that God is in control means two things. I want us to see that it means that, in Paul's words, I want us to see the goodness and the severity of God. The fact that God's in control means that we're going to see an aspect of goodness from that, from the fact that he's in control, and we're going to see an aspect of severity in the fact that he's in control. Now, what we're talking about, and the basic subject is going to be the church, as in a sense, we're not going to be talking about God in control of everything. We're going to be talking about God is in control of the church, and he's in control of the fact that the church exists. He's in control of the fact that the church is going to exist throughout time. And we're going to be considering the church as it has been from its very beginning up until the time that Christ returns. When I'm just going to put a beginning on it at the time when God appeared to Abraham and said, "Abraham, come out from among your people." And Abraham, by faith, followed God. He left all that he had. Well, he left his people. He left his comfortable surroundings. He stepped out of his comfort zone and followed after God. And by doing that, he pleased God. And God was pleased with him as a man. He was called the friend of God. Abraham had it figured out, at least in a basic sense of what it meant to follow God. He would hear what God had to say, and he would believe it, and he would base his life on what God said, and he'd follow him by faith. God said to Abraham, "I'll make of you a great nation. If you follow me, I'll make of your seed a great nation, and I'll give to that nation a plot of land. I'll give them a place of inheritance, and I'll give them a land to inherit. I will hand it to them. It will be their land. They'll be to me a people, and I'll be to them a God." It was a relationship that he was establishing with Abraham and then with his seed. And then, as time goes forward, they sometimes fulfilled their end of the bargain. Sometimes they did not. But it never, and things got really bad. You remember? If you look through the Old Testament, and you review this history of that part of the church, of the Old Testament church, with the people of Israel following after God, many times they didn't follow after God. They would raise up idols, they would build idols, they would raise up altars to false gods, they would sacrifice to those false gods, they would believe the wrong things, they would make leagues with the other nations that they shouldn't make. They did many things wrong. It's a long laundry list of things that they didn't do right. And you find these ebbs and flows of up and down times in the Old Testament. More down times than up. But it never ended, did it? As bad as it got, it never ended. God was always fully in control. They made their decisions. They made a lot of bad decisions. But it never meant that this successive relationship between the people of God and their God, it never ended. Even though whether it ended or not was up to the people of God, it would have ended. They did enough to end it. But God always gave them a champion, always gave them a king, always gave them someone to bring them out from where they were. He always did what he needed to do to keep the cycle going, the perpetuity of the church. From the time he appeared to Abraham, was not on Abraham's shoulders. It was on God's. And it just kept going. And we see the times that were bad, and we're going to review just one of those times that he brings up in the 11th. But we see that it was given to Israel. It's something we're familiar with, but it's something that he deals with quite a lot here, proving to them that there came a time in this line of succession where, let's say that let's think of it as a train that's going down a track, and God is the one providing the steam for the engine. It's not going to stop. There may be people who are in line, a generation that's doing right and is able to enjoy the fruits of this relationship with God, and there are generations that don't, but it never sets the train off the track. You see, it just keeps going. God is always there. God is still, in the Old Testament, he's still in between the two cherubims, right? God is still dwelling with Israel. They haven't lost him, right? They haven't lost God. He's still there. And then there comes a point where it's not only going to be about Abraham's seed by genealogy anymore. There came a time when things were going to change. He was going to, in a sense, switch the track, if you will, of this train. Things were going to be reformed. We know that term, reformation, refers to the time when Christ came and changed the church. The only one who could change the church from an Old Testament church to what we would refer to as the New Testament church. That was a part of the perpetuity of the church. There was, in a sense, an end of an era, but the church didn't end with Christ coming back and fulfilling the law and changing it from the Old Testament law service to the New Testament church, or what I would call in love service, under him, under the Father, and under the auspices of, and in the way that we know the church to be today. It doesn't look like the Old Testament church. We don't make sacrifices. We didn't build this building in accordance to what the tabernacle was supposed to be built to. Obviously, it's not made of gold. We don't live our lives day to day under the law like they did back then. It's totally changed. But it's still a continuance of the same thing, you see. God, and it's even closer to what it was in the beginning, when God appeared to Abraham and called him out to follow him by faith, and Abraham followed him by faith. So you see that very highlighted version of the, and very shortened form of the history of the church. Starts with Abraham, comes down, and then the law is given. They live under the law for hundreds and hundreds of years, and then Christ comes, changes the entire game to what we now know it to be, but it's the same line. It's a continuity of the same idea. The people of God and God following after their God. And with that in mind, we'll start in Romans chapter 9, and we'll start in the 30th verse with this thought. Paul asks the question, "What shall we say then, that the Gentiles, which followed not after righteousness, have attained to righteousness, even the righteousness which is of faith?" He's saying, we know that it's been about the Israelites up until now, but we know that the Gentiles have attained unto righteousness. How have they attained that? They've attained it by faith. But Israel, which was the people of God for all these hundreds of years, which had the law, which had the oracles of God, which had all, were basically the people of God. But Israel, which followed after the law of righteousness, hath not attained to the law of righteousness. It was perplexing to the Israelites how this happened. It was perplexing that the train, which seemed to be going down the track just as good as it could, suddenly switched. They didn't see how that could happen. They didn't understand what went wrong. He says, wherefore? Because they sought it not by faith, but as it were by the works of the law. For they stumbled at that stumbling stone. As it is written, behold, I lay in Zion a stumbling stone and rock of offense, and whosoever believeth on him shall not be ashamed. He's talking about Jesus. He's saying Jesus was a stumbling stone. He was an offense to the Israelites. Jesus was the only one that could change the course of this train. He was the only one with the authority to go and throw that switch and switch the track to where, and what I mean by that is it was now inclusive of the Gentiles. That's the basic, in a nutshell, what happened. He came and he made it where, in all his reformation of the Old Testament church, part of that reformation included an expanding of the canopy, if you will, to not include, it no longer included the descendants of Abraham by genealogy. It was no longer necessary for you to trace your lineage back to Abraham physically in order to be of the people of God. To be an Israelite did not mean that you were one of the people of God, the ones who follow after God and God leads you. Now, it was based on Abraham by faith. He was faithful to God. What qualified you to be in there was your lineage to God. And what got you in there was being faithful as Abraham was faithful. To walk, to believe God and follow after God in the same manner that Abraham did. Much simpler, and it meant that anybody who was born of God and believed in God could follow after God and be part of the New Testament church. Things were different from then on. And the Jews had a very hard time coming to grips with this. And that's a lot of what Paul is saying here. They at first rejected the idea that things were changing. And once they saw things were changing, they had a hard time dealing with the knowledge and the obviousness that things had changed. And it was rattling to them. It was earth-shattering to an Israelite who saw that their whole world was coming down around them. Things had been changed. It took some time, but that was the realization that they had to come to. And Jesus was the one that caused that stumbling. Because, see, in their mind, it was the keeping of the law that justified you before God. It was the not eating the right things and eating the right things and keeping yourself under the law. Well, Jesus comes and confounds all that because now he's kept the law. The law was supposed to show them that they needed somebody else to keep the law because they couldn't do it on their own. That was the purpose of the law. So they misinterpreted what the law was for in the first place. If I give you a car and say, well, what's a good analogy for that? Let's say I give you an airplane and I just give you an airplane. And it's for flying. You don't know how to fly. You can't fly, right? So you're going to sit there and look at that plane, and you know you can't fly it, so you're going to use it for something else. Let's say you put flowers in it, and you just fill it with dirt, and you put flowers in it, you grow flowers. You think, well, I'm using what you gave me, and you think you're doing the right thing with that airplane. Then someone comes along and says, no, that's not what it's for. You can't, that doesn't do you any good. And they fly the plane off. Now what do you do? That doesn't fit too well. But you see that the law was given to them to teach them something. And they never learned it because they didn't use it the right way. They never learned, at least the majority of them, didn't learn what they were supposed to from the law. And so they didn't see that they needed any help. They were supposed to see a need for help. You know, if I actually try to fly a plane, I guess it's the better analogy, and I get up in the air and I don't know what I'm doing, I'm going to be scared. I'm going to need some help. I'm going to be radioing SOS. I'm going to need somebody to help me out flying this plane. So they were supposed to see that they needed help. And they were supposed to be looking desperately for someone to come and fulfill this law and save them. They were supposed to be looking for a Savior. But in their taking of the law and saying, oh, we can do this, and fulfilling it and thinking that they had fulfilled it, they saw no need for anyone to help them do what they were doing perfectly fine. But Jesus comes and starts fulfilling the law. He comes, and his whole personality is different from theirs. You see, his whole approach to life and the law and God is totally different from theirs. So if I set out to build another one of these, another stand over here, I'm not a woodworker. I'm not going to do a good job with it. So if I start doing it and it's not looking quite right, and then, you know, Brother Danny comes over and starts to help me out to build it, and I think I know what I'm doing, and he really knows what he's doing, he's going to get in my way, right? Because I'm convinced I know what I'm doing. They're set leading the people of God, instructing the people of God, being righteous as they think they are. They think they're doing a good job. So when Jesus comes on the scene and he starts doing it correctly, he's in their way, you see. They don't like people to be in their way. So they want to get him out of their way to continue on the path they were on. So he was a rock of offense, and he caused them to stumble. They didn't get him. They didn't like him. They wanted to kill him, and that's exactly what they called for when he basically gave them the opportunity to do what they would. They cried out, crucify him, crucify him. There was a lot of them that never saw the light. This is how it happened. Jesus comes to his own, and his own receive him not. And they are blinded, in part by blinded by themselves, blinded by their own conceits, blinded by their own quote-unquote righteousness. There was also a blinding by God upon them, upon some of them. I don't know what the percentage of those that were blinded of themselves and those that were blinded of God, but he describes that some of them were blinded by God. There was a purpose in it. That they believe not. They didn't follow after God like Abraham. And so when Jesus comes to them as the last of their prophets, as the greatest prophet, and he prophesies to them that basically they're doing things wrong. They're a generation of vipers. That the judgment upon all the prophets and the men of God that have been killed would come upon that generation. It was because he was coming to them as their prophet. And when they rejected him, it was like a car backing out of the space. Let's read a little more. But it was like the emptying of a slot that could now be filled by another people, because of their rejection of him. We're going to skip primarily chapter 10. We'll read the last part. Let's read the 19th verse of the 10th chapter. But I say, did not Israel know? It's a good question for right here in our discussion. Didn't they know there was a man coming? They might not have known his name was Jesus. They thought his name was going to be Emmanuel. Didn't they know that a man was coming that was going to change everything? Didn't they know by the scriptures of the Old Testament that there was going to be the gospel was going to be preached to the Gentiles? It's pretty laid out, you know, in the Old Testament. He's about to show that. He's about to bring up a few examples of that, just as he did in the 9th chapter. That, yeah, they should have known. He said, did not Israel know? First Moses saith, I will provoke you to jealousy by them that are no people, and by a foolish nation I will anger you. But Isaiah is very bold, and saith, I was found of them that sought me not. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. Talking about the Gentiles. But to Israel he saith, All day long I have stretched forth my hands unto a disobedient and gainsaying people. He's saying God looks at the scene in the generation of Jesus and says, here you've got my people, right? Just as we talked about in the lineage of Abraham, his people, the train going down the track. These are the people. These are the people of God who, when God comes to them, they say, kill that guy. Get him out of here. That's where they were at this point. It was a low point. Just as it was back when Elijah was being a prophet, when he was doing the work of God, things were at a low point. Things are at a very low point here. God appears to his people and they say, kill him. And you've got, here's the people of God, and then here's these other people who are not the people of God under the other definition of the people of God. They weren't the people of Abraham. They were born of God, but they were not under that canopy to be following after God and God leading them as a people under the covenant with Abraham. They weren't in that covenant, you see. And these people reject him. He stretches out his hands to these people, and they're gainsaying and disobedient. And they say, we don't want you. Don't reach to us because we don't want you. And so he reaches to these people, and he brings them in. You see? That's the picture that he's painting. These people reject him. God is in control. He's good to these people and severe to those that rejected him. Let's get back to our overall idea. God is in control. There seems to be a problem. God's people are rejecting him. To the nth degree, they're rejecting him. They're rejecting his son. They're rejecting his highest and most respected, pure, perfect prophet. They reject him. There's a huge problem. But God is in control. What does he do? He's so wise that he uses this awful offense to bring in the other and include the other of his, truly his people, which now under the new, I don't want to say restrictions, but the new label of his people is no longer by genealogy, right? It's by spiritual birth. This fits. It's better for it to not only include the Jews now, it's better for it to include also the Gentiles, because they fit this new labeling, this new category of the people of God, because it's more inclusive. It includes the possibility for all those who are born of God to now be qualified to be in the New Testament church. They have the ability to be in there. They're not cut off because of they're not being of in the genealogy of Abraham. So he is now able to include the Gentiles into the mix. Then he asked the question in the 11th chapter. I say then, hath God cast away his people? Has he now said no more Jews, just Gentiles? That was what was scaring them. It had become obvious to them that the Gentiles had been included. Well, if they've been included, does that now mean that we are excluded? You can see how that would be scary for them. He's obviously changed the rules. He's obviously changed the game. He's reformed this whole relationship of God to his people. It's changed. Has he cut us off? And that's what he deals with in this chapter. And this is what gets to the real crux of what I'm wanting to see him teach. He says, God forbid, for I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. He said, well, here's your first bit of proof that God has not cut off the Israelites, because I'm an Israelite and I'm an apostle of God. I am given to you Gentiles. No, God has not cut off his people. At least if you're counting, here's one, and I know of others. So no, he is not. God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew. What ye not the scripture saith of Elias, how he maketh intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets, they have digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. As we said, in the history of the church, you have low points. This was a low point where Elijah was being pursued by Jezebel. Elijah had just done some great things, but Israel was totally against him. Israel was going after false gods again, and he was running for his life. And Elijah cries out to God, God, things are as bad as they've ever been. He says, they've killed all your prophets, and I'm the only one left. And they're going to kill me. They're trying to kill me. Things are as bad as they could get. You see that the desperation. And I want to ask you, do you ever feel desperation about the condition of the church now? Do you ever see that things are going down? That the churches, there are less people in the churches. The people that are in the churches are less concerned than they used to be. That there are less churches altogether. Churches die, you see. And if you look at our recent history, yes, things are on a downward slope than what they were 100 years ago, right? If we're looking at the history of the church. But here you have an instance where Elijah says, and we're talking about the same church. I want you to believe that. Elijah is saying, it's down to one. It's down to one. And they're going to take away that one. What is he talking about? He is talking about an end to the perpetuity of the church. In his mind, he feels like he's convinced. He's the last one of this lineage. And he is going to get cut off and it's going to be over. You see? That's where he was. He was in a dark place. What did God say to him? But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. What was the message? God is in control. You do what you can, Elijah. You do what you can as preachers and as members of the church, but at the end of the day, God's in control. What he's really saying there is that there is a selected group of people who will always be faithful to God. In every generation, there is a group of people. God, this is not the only time God has done this. This was part of a cycle, if I understand what Paul is teaching. That now, there is a group of people who are faithful to God, who will remain to be faithful to God, and God takes care of that. There are people that I don't know about, are people that I do know. I don't know. But God is going to keep his church here until he comes back. It's not us that keep his church here until he comes back. You see, what we do helps that, plays into that. But if we do nothing, he'll take care of it. See, because he's in control. And whenever we see things getting bad or worse, may we remember the goodness of God. That's the part of his being in control that we see here, is his goodness. In this relationship that we have with him, he is the man. He is the male counterpart. He is the male part of the half. We are described as the bride. We are described as the female part of the half. So that there are things for us to do. There are plenty of things, important things for us to do as the bride. But we must understand that that is our role. We are not the male part of the half. And the good thing for a husband to do, a man of the house to do, is to be in control. Not controlling, not having to take care of everything. God doesn't take care of everything in the church. There are things we do. He's not going to take care of everything. If we drop the ball, sure, he'll probably pick it up for us. But there are things for us to do, and there are things that he does, but he is fully in control. Man should be fully in control of his house. He should be on the ball, not lazy, not non-caring of what's going on in his household. He should be in control. And when he's not, Tell me if this is not true in all of your lives, that if the man's not in control, the woman will be. She'll pick up his slack if he's lazy, if he's not in control. And she shouldn't have to put up with that, correct? Is that a? I think that's a correct observation of what goes on in human relationship. Men should be in control. When they're not, the women will be. And the women shouldn't have to be in control of everything that's going on in the house. They should have a man they can rely on. God is always going to be that way. We can always rely on Him. The church is always going to be here in some form when He comes back because He's in control and we can lean on Him. He is in control, and because He's in control, we see a goodness of God because of it. He says, he asked the question in the 11th verse, I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? God forbid that they should be totally cut off. He says, God forbid. Rather, through their fall, salvation has come to the Gentiles for to provoke them to jealousy. Now, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, and the diminishing of them the riches of the Gentiles, how much more their fullness? For I speak to you Gentiles, inasmuch as I am the apostle of the Gentiles, I magnify mine office, if by any means I may provoke to emulation them which are of my flesh, and might save some of them. For if the casting away of them be the reconciling of the world, what shall the receiving of them be but life from the dead? Simply all he's saying there is that now that the Israelites are starting to see that things have changed, and the blessings, the riches that were given to them in the relationship with Abraham and Moses and in the people of God, that has been given to the Gentiles, it makes them jealous. And they seek to attain those things again and be brought back into the fold, those that were cut off. He's saying it worked out, God worked it out perfectly so that both are made to be on the same level. Let's read. Let's skip ahead a little bit. He says, and if the root be holy, so are the branches. 17th verse. And if some of the branches be broken off, and thou, being a wild olive tree, wert grafted in among them, and with them partakest of the root and fatness of the olive tree, boast not against the branches, but if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. If thou wilt say then, the branches were broken off that I might be grafted in, well, because of unbelief, they were broken off, and thou standest by faith. Be not high-minded, but fear. He's using an analogy of a tree to show what we've been considering. That it's like an olive tree where God is the root. He's the trunk of the tree. The part that just goes laterally, up and down. And then the Israelites were like the branches that come out of that tree. He's describing the train that I talked about before as a tree. That it just keeps on going through time, and there are these branches that shoot out and are part of this relationship to God. Some, when Christ comes, didn't believe Him. They rejected Him. So God's reaction to that was, He broke those limbs off, cast them away, takes off branches from a wild tree, and grafts them into that tree. You can do that. I'm sure you're aware of that. It amazed me in reading this years ago that you could do that to a tree. Just like you'd put a new limb onto a person, you know, a new organ, and we can accept it. Same thing with a tree. You can break a limb off, put another limb on from another tree, and it will accept it and start to actually bear fruit and live on that new tree. He's saying that's what's happened. That's a way to describe what happened with Israel. In this time of Reformation, they rejected God, and He broke off some of the branches. And then He put in the Gentiles. And His lesson, and we first see the goodness of God in that. He shows His goodness to the Gentiles. But in the same breath, He says to the Gentiles, don't be high-minded. Yes, you've been included into something that you wouldn't have been included in because of the unbelief of these Israelites. Now, be not high-minded, but fear. Now comes the more serious part of it. If we're not going to be concerned about whether the church is going to be here or not, if that's not really for us to be concerned about, what are we supposed to be concerned about? It's supposed to lift a burden off of our shoulders to not think, oh, woe is me, what are we going to do? Because the church is just going to fizzle out and die. No, it's not going to fizzle out and die. Even if it doesn't exist in the United States, it's not going to fizzle out and die. And I don't think it's not going to exist here. I think it is. I think there is an upshoot of vitality and an existence of the Holy Spirit here, which is a measure of whether he's here or not. The Old Testament measure for it was whether he was between the cherubims. The New Testament measure is whether his Spirit is residing in the churches or not. And I believe it is. I believe he is abiding within his churches. I don't think we need to worry about that. It's going to be here. It's going to stay. So what are we to fear? What are we to fear? For if God spared not the natural branches, take heed, lest he also spare not thee. God is a God of severity. He's a God that's in control. We may let things go. He doesn't let things go. He's like, and a good way to think about this is, he's like the highest ranking member of this military. He's been through it. He knows what it's all about. He's spent hundreds of years in this warfare, if you will, in the fight. He's spent all this time as a career military man. And when we enlist to this, when we become a part of this, he's the head honcho. He is the highest ranking man. And he doesn't slack off. If we don't do what we're supposed to do, if we take this lightly, he doesn't. If you go in the military and it's a joke to you, they'll either change it from being a joke or they will set you on your way. They don't take jokers, right? It's something to be respected and something to be taken seriously. And that's how he views this. He says, if you don't take this seriously, you've been given a great opportunity, is what he's saying, being grafted into this tree. But if you don't take it seriously, he'll break you off too. You don't think he can, you just get high-minded. Who was high-minded? The Jews, right? We have all this dialogue, all this occurrence throughout the Gospels of what happened between these high-minded people and Jesus, right? He lifted out his hands to a gainsaying and disobedient people, and then he broke them off. Why is it there except to show us and tell us, don't be high-minded, or he will break you off? Who do we really think we are as a primitive Baptist church, as one who's been here for, 100-something years, do we think that means to God he doesn't have the authority to say to us, off with you? Do we think he can't do that, is the question. Do we think he can't do that to an individual or to a church as a whole or to a nation? You know, I don't think it's going to happen that way. I was going to say to a nation of churches, but I looking at the pattern that we're going to look at in Revelation, it's church by church. He judges individual churches. And once an individual church has been judged, he then will accept individuals within the church. And we'll see that in Revelation. But I want us to get this one point that he's making, that God is in control of the church with a hand of goodness and with a hand of severity. But at all times, he's in control. And then the verse that really is what I'm trying to say. Behold, therefore, the goodness and severity of God on them which fell severity, but toward thee goodness, if thou continue in his goodness, otherwise thou also shalt be cut off. God has always been this way. It sounds severe and militaristic, but it's the way he's always been. If you look at the Old Testament, when he said, don't touch the ark, he meant, don't touch the ark. Because even when someone with good intention tried to, remember, settle the ark when it was rattling, they fell dead. God means what he says. When he said, don't offer the wrong thing on the altar, when they did, they died. God sets these rules, and he says, and he expects us to follow them. You see, we have gotten into this whole thing of being a member of the church and following after God, being the people of God. It was not mandatory, right? You don't have to be a member of the church. No one forced you to get baptized, right? I don't think it was that way. It wasn't that way with me. I've never heard of it being that way. We're not coerced. We do this voluntarily. And when we do, we're becoming a part of a high and holy thing. But there are expectations of us as a church and as members of that body. We don't get married to be single. See what I mean? We have chosen to be a part of a bride that is married to a husband. And we have a relationship to be a part of, you see. It's not something to be taken lackadaisically, to be followed in lazily. Because if you're married and act like you're single, you won't be married long, you see. Let's just continue reading down here and then we'll get on over to Revelation. For if thou wert cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and wert grafted in contrary to nature into a good olive tree, how much more shall these, which be the natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? It would be easy for God to do that, he's saying. For I would not, brethren, that ye should be ignorant of this mystery, lest ye should be wise in your own conceits, that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. And so all Israel shall be saved, as it is written, there shall come out of... And he's saying that God, in part, orchestrated it so that the Gentiles and the Jews would be in the New Testament church. And then he rejoices in the wisdom of God and the ability of God to perform that in that time of Reformation. Now, let's look at the book of Revelation. We'll start in chapter 3. And we're just going to look at some examples. Chapter 2, I apologize. Some of the examples of God writing to New Testament churches. The seven churches of Asia. God appears to John on the island of Patmos and says, I'm going to reveal things to you. I want you to write them down. I want you to send them to the seven churches of Asia. These were letters to the churches from Jesus himself. And they read kind of like progress reports. They read like report cards from school. He'll say, in this area, you're doing well. In this area, you need improvement. And in this area, you're doing well. It kind of reads like that. He addresses them all similarly. They all have different pros and cons that are going on in their churches. But he addresses them the same way. And he addresses them, what I want you to see out of this more than anything else, is that he addresses them with severity. He really does. Because what Elijah learned, when God said to him, I've got 7,000. The first thing is a weight coming off. Okay, I'm not the only one, right? There are 7,000. That I was wrong about that concept that I'm the last one. And that God is in control. And that the church is still going to be here, even if I don't succeed. But the very next thought is, it doesn't really matter so much if I die. You see, because he's thinking, I've got to stay alive for this thing to keep on going, right? And God's going to have to keep me alive because if I don't stay alive, it's all over. Not really. God says, I've got 7,000 over here. If you die, it's going to keep going. You see, so at first it's a comforting thought, and then it's kind of a fearful thought because, well, God doesn't really need me as much as I thought he needed me. So the first idea that God is going to have a church here, whether we do anything to get it there or not, is comforting at first. And then we realize God doesn't really need you, right? He wants you. He wants you to be a part of this. He wants you to take this seriously. He wants you to be in his army, if you will. I just like that because it's very a rigid way of thinking about it. It is a marriage. It's not so much just like, okay, I've joined the military. I don't want you to get that idea. It's a relationship between a husband and his bride. It's sweet and romantic, and it brings you great joy and peace. But if we don't take it seriously, it falls more into the category of, you know what? If you don't take this seriously, I don't need you around. I don't need you to make sure this goes correctly. You know, if we become high-minded, as he said before. So he writes to these churches, and he writes in that way. He says to the church of Ephesus, he says that they're basically a great church. They're doing a lot of things right. He says in the second verse, and I'm going to read through these kind of quickly. Second verse, I know thy works and thy labor, thy patience, how thou canst not bear them which are evil, and thou hast tried them which say they are apostles and are not, hast found them liars. Thou hast borne and hast patience for my name's sake. Thou hast labored and hast not fainted. Nevertheless, I have somewhat against thee, because thou hast left thy first love. He's saying in essence they don't do things out of love for him like they did before. It's more about them than it is him. They've done a lot, but there's a heart issue. There's a heart problem. They look like a strong, viable, pressing forward church, alive and active, but their heart is in the wrong place. And I can't describe to you exactly what he means by that, but hopefully they understood what he meant when he said, you've left your first love. Your heart needs some readjusting. And look at what he says. If they don't fix it, he says, remember therefore whence thou art fallen, and repent and do the first works, or what? Or else I will come unto thee quickly and remove thy candlestick out of his place, except thou repent. What does he mean by that? He means, I'll remove the spirit from you. I'll remove your standing as a church. You'll no longer be a church. You'll be dead. That's severe. Because it seems like they're doing a lot of things right. God is his own judge. God is his own good and perfect judge upon a church. We may think we're doing things right, but we still appeal to him as the one who judges. This needs to be fixed. That's doing well. There's only one church that he doesn't find anything or doesn't point out anything wrong to them. This is not one of them. And now, by the example of the Gentiles and the Jews, we now see that if that candlestick is taken away, where it's going? It's going to somebody else. It doesn't get tossed in the trash bin. It just gets given somewhere else. But this thou hast, that thou hatest the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which are things which I also hate. He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit saith to the churches. To him that overcometh will I give to eat of the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. There's always that ending phrase, to him that overcometh. I've told you what's right. I've told you what's wrong. Now, to him that takes it seriously and overcomes this obstacle, I will reward him. He talks about different rewards and different obstacles to overcome, but in each place he says, to him that overcometh. If the church overcomes as a whole, great. The whole church will be blessed. But if a portion of the church or an individual in the church hears God as he speaks to the church, if they overcome, they will be blessed. That's the promise. And I don't think there's any way to draw a conclusion that God deals with his churches any differently than he is right here. The same thing goes on right now. Because we are this church, Mount Olive, is as much a church of God as Ephesus was. Same qualifications, same existence, same relationship with God, same goodness, same severity. And it's just something we need to be cognizant of, aware of, and take for what it is. He then says, write to the angel of the church at Smyrna, these things saith the first and the last, which was dead and is alive. I know thy works, thy tribulation and poverty. And this is the one that, he doesn't say anything to. He doesn't say that there's anything wrong with the church at Smyrna, so we'll skip it. It doesn't really fit our purposes so much today. He then writes to the church at, he says, to the angel of the church at Pergamos, in the 12th verse, write, these things saith he which hath the sharp sword with two edges, I know thy works, where thou dwellest, even where Satan's seat is, and thou holdest fast my name. Thou hast not denied my faith, even in those days when Antipas was my faithful martyr, who was slain among you where Satan dwelleth. He's talking to a church that is doing most everything correctly, and they are suffering. I want you to see this, because this is amazing to me. He's talking to a suffering church. A church that is suffering persecution. Where members of their church have actually been killed. Now, if I were talking to that church, if I were to stand up and preach to that church, how could I say anything except have glowing admiration for them and look at them as higher than me? Jesus doesn't do that. He tells them exactly what they're doing right, but then as the top soldier can look at a soldier who's in the trenches and grab him and shake him and make him do even better, he's the only one that can speak to him that way. I couldn't say what he's about to say to the church at Pergamos. I'm not qualified unless he put it, you know, not seriously. He's the only one that can address a church in this way. He says to the church at Pergamos, but I have a few things against thee. People are dying there, but he says, I have a few things against thee. This is a hard man. This is a serious man. Because thou hast there them that hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling stone before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed unto idols and to commit fornication. So hast thou also them that which hold the doctrine of the Nicolaitans, which things I hate. He's already said that before. Repent, or else I will come unto thee quickly and will fight against them with the sword of my mouth. He's saying, you've done a great job. You're suffering for my name's sake. I also have been there. I've suffered wrongfully. I've suffered persecution. I know what that's like. And I can talk to you and say, you're doing a good job there. But there's some doctrines you need to fix. And if you don't fix them, I'll come fix them, is what he's saying. Still, severity. Because he wants things done correctly. He wants us, I think, what I extrapolate from this, more than anything else, he wants us to take this seriously. And he wants us to take him seriously. When he says something, he wants us to listen and not have to ask what he said. How does he speak to us? He speaks to us individually. He speaks to us through preachers more than anything else. But he's always going to speak to us through this. And if it's inconsistent or incorrect, he's not speaking. He's always concise. He's always consistent. And he's always clear. And when we hear him, may we not act like we didn't. Because as a church, we're here to hear from God. It's not a fairy tale. It's not something that's just within these pages. It happens every day. It happens at least once a week to us as a church. I want us to read. We'll read two more and then we'll stop. Time is pretty much out. But he says to in the third chapter, to write unto the church at Sardis, these things saith he that hath the seven spirits of God. This one's sad. And the seven stars, and I know that I know thy works, that thou hast a name that thou livest and art dead. Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die. For I have found thy works, but I have not found thy works perfect before God. Remember, this is like a church on its deathbed. Even though it doesn't look like it's on its deathbed to the people that see it. See, God judges by a different eye than we do. When we see a church, I can judge a church to be healthy and growing and great. God looks at it totally differently because He can see aspects of the people's heart. He understands the doctrines that they're espousing in ways I can't. You see, He measures the health of a church very differently than we do. And so that's why we have to listen to Him, not a group of preachers, not some board of counselors or each other, or the opinion of another church. It's us and Him, independent of everything else. It's you as a church and this man who is overqualified to be your husband and to be your leader. Even with this church, what I want to get out of this is the fact that even though this church is pretty much dead, and He says there's no hope for you, you're dead. You know, He just takes the pulse and says, it's slowing down, it's going to die. He says, thou hast a few names, even in Sardis, which have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy. He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and his angels. So what he's saying is what I said before, that he considers a church as a whole body. And if things aren't going well, he considers individuals. And he takes individual accounts of whether you have overcome or not overcome. So even wrapped in this severity, there is a hand of goodness. You see, he extends his hand. He says, he doesn't just do it. He'll tell you what's wrong. Always. He'll tell you what you're doing right. He'll tell you what you're doing wrong. He'll tell you where you need to repent. And then he'll reach out his arm and say you're going to do it or not. And if you don't expect a second chance. You might get it, but don't expect it. He's a God of goodness and severity to his church. The last one I want to see is the church at Laodicea. Because I believe that their specific problems are very similar to the specific problems we see as American churches. This was the American church, if you will. They had the same problems that we chronically have. This is the 14th verse of the third chapter. Under the angel of the church of Laodicea, of the Laodiceans write, these things saith the Amen, the faithful and the true witness, the beginning of the creation of God. I know thy works, that thou art neither cold nor hot. I would that thou wert cold or hot. So then, because thou art lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew thee out of my mouth. What does he mean by that? I believe what he means by that is they were going through the motions. Church for them was a routine. The same thing happened, I think it's the 66th chapter of Isaiah, he describes this. That it was just, whatever, you know, let's go, we'll sing, we'll listen to preaching for an hour, and we'll bow our heads when they pray, and we'll turn it back off when we leave. You know, I've done that many times, especially earlier in my life, where church was just more a social function than anything else. When church becomes a social function, we're not cold or hot. We're just there. You know, we're not really plugged into it. We're just filling space and seat. He's saying, when you act that way toward me in my church, you know, I take a sip of that and I spew it out. It's like drinking cold coffee or hot Coca-Cola. You know, you don't want it in your mouth. You spit it out. He doesn't like that. Attitude. When we have that attitude of just whatever, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm not really listening. I'm not. I don't really care. He hates that. He spews it out, just as we would spew out cold coffee. Because thou sayest, I am rich and increased with goods, and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. He's saying that their riches, their physical riches, blinded.